Well, thanks for coming. I think most of you probably have already heard from Patty in terms of what she's doing. She's a longtime friend that I've known for many, many years, and it's just, which is true of a number of people who are here this morning. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I'm delighted to have her and to share some of what she is doing now, what she has done, and just the importance of art in healing, which is really a lot of what this weekend is about. So, Patty.
Okay. Well, I'm excited that you've all come. And just, I want to say thank you to Linda for inviting me. I met Linda in Bellingham in my other incarnation as a graphic designer years ago, and worked together with Linda to produce the graphics and artwork for, I don't know how many.
Quite a few.
Five, maybe, of her albums or her CDs. Yeah. Wow. And so it's a real heartfelt connection that we have. And my son became a musician, so I commiserate with her about what that's like to, you know, have a musician in the family. Anyway, what I've come to talk to you today about, I've explained before, is this project, the Dignity Quilt. And it is so much work about healing and about spontaneity, about just sitting down and being where people are at. And in art therapy, this methodology is called phenomenology. And it took me years to get my mind around what this concept was, and I kept asking Kay, you know, what do you mean, you know? And she says, well, it means when you sit down with people, you know nothing. And I could not rock that for a really long time. I'm a really cerebral artist. I like to figure things out. I like to know what I'm doing. But it is, whatever arises is what you deal with, what people want to talk about, you know. And sometimes you have to be creative about entering the process, but it can be just something really small and not directive. Like, you can say, if people are confused, I'm no artist, I can't do this. You just say, well, what's your favorite color? And they always have an answer. And then you're in the process. So it's not about saying, well, you know, trying to fix it. It's just about that phenomenological occurrence, what's happening. So I first moved to Victoria in 2005 from Bellingham to help my folks. My mom had developed dementia, and my stepfather was just too much for him to handle. And I was at a place in my life where a transition was important for me, and I said, well, I could come. I really want to explore art therapy, and I can help you too. And my stepfather just said, well, when are you coming? So I just kind of, you know, uprooted myself and moved to Bellingham, or from Bellingham to Victoria, and started the art therapy program and helped my folks move off Salt Spring, get settled in a retirement residence, and became their primary care management person. I mean, I was a team with my dad, but it turned out he needed a lot of help too. I mean, he had so much grief and loss and despair about losing my mom. We both did. But somebody had to be there to do that, and I was the designated person. So, where do I begin? I got to get in here. I'm going to just start here, and we'll just start looking at some of the work of the people that I began working with, because when I first started, I started because I needed a project for my thesis, and my supervisor said, oh, here's a place, it's a dementia care facility, and they want a feasibility study to see if there's anything that art therapy provides that their recreation and activities programming is not providing for people. And I said, oh my God, more dementia, you know, I'm just immersing it with my family. She says, oh, it'll be really good for you then. You know, and so I did. And I started going to the care facility 2 days a week, just in the afternoons, and began to learn about working in medical full-blown dementia care facility, 117-bed facility. And it was very difficult for me at first. I was really, like anybody that walks into a long-term care facility, the smell hits you, and then you get used to it. The people's, you know, sort of distance and decline and disassociation, and just, you know, having medical stuff everywhere all the time. But I just trusted the process, which is part of art therapy, to just trust the process, and began creating an art therapy program and having paints and brushes, and people started coming. I started meeting people, getting to know them, and you'll see from the rest of the work here what began to happen. So I now wore two hats at this facility. I became the part-time art therapist, and in 2008, I actually got my mom into this facility. So I found this quote on the bulletin board when I first began my work at the pavilion, and I vowed to have it frame my interaction with the residents. And it's so true. In this world, without dementia, we wouldn't have people that would help us, that remembering and planning and naming and knowing are not the key activities of human life, but feeling and being and touching and singing and creativity of all kinds. These help people identify themselves as individuals and opens their heart. So I found that all the creative parts can bring a sense of purpose and meaning to people's lives. So this Kiwanis Pavilion is in Victoria, B.C., and it's a 117-bed facility, and it specializes in dementia care. And my work began there, first as this practicum student, and then the facility offered this stipend for the feasibility study, and I began to see that what I was doing with people was really important. So this work that you're seeing now is all done by people with dementia. And when I sat down to present my case study, the executive board of administrators, nurses, and healthcare professionals, they were stunned by the residents' range of expression. Unbeknownst to me, the resident whose work I've shown in this case study had been one of the most resistant to any of the other programming options that the facility had to offer, which only reinforced their realization that what we call person-centered care, person-centered programming, was necessary. The executive director and the Kiwanis Foundation made a commitment to create a part-time art therapy position, and I began working 2 days a week and continued my learning from the residents. Many thanks to Thelma and her artistry. My supervisor during my practicum, Margaret McQuay, was an occupational therapist. It was her invaluable experience that helped me begin to interface with a complex dementia care facility with a medical model orientation. Without her help, I would have been overwhelmed. It was her inspiration to recommission an old medications cart and rechristen it as the art cart. Now I was mobile and could set up small studios in the unit solarium. This is one on unit 2. And work one-to-one with a resident wherever I found a quiet spot. I had two ways of working with people. These studios, when I found that people could have some autonomy, handle the materials, do things on their own, I could work with more than just one person. But in order to get them into the studio, I had to do a one-to-one kind of evaluation to make sure that they could participate in a more group setting. Thank you. It's 6 o'clock. So art therapy has as many modalities and as many ways to work with people as there are individuals. Working with people with dementia, I found the concept called the third hand a very useful place to begin. Developed by art therapist Edith Kramer in the mid-80s, she describes it as the employment of imagination and virtuosity in the empathic service of others. My goal with residents is to have a heartfelt exchange that provides them with a feeling of personal accomplishment, what I've come to call supported autonomy. Sometimes I will contribute something to their piece to keep a resident engaged. I follow their direction and request to support them through the process until their confidence increases and they can carry on alone and with minimal input from me. I call these conversation paintings. Evie's story is a good example. She was often definite about her plans for painting. I want to paint a room with a pink wall and a brown couch, she told me. Her range of motion was limited, and after some rather clumsy efforts to mix the paint and load her brush, I offered to mix the colors, and she quickly responded, well, hurry up. I made a joke about being her painting slave, and she laughed and agreed that I was a valuable component to her painting process. We had been working this way regularly for several weeks, and I had gotten to know many other things about the resident's life besides her quick sense of humor. I always had an ever-changing art exhibit on our bulletin board in the main hallway. Putting up residents' work affirmed their identity and always made them smile. It also helped all the staff and family members increase and broaden their understanding of the residents' abilities. The collage box was another tool I used that could help residents overcome their claim, I'm no artist, and reduce the stress around drawing. It could be a good place to find a beginning image and then add color and context, or a way to embellish a very good start. This is a portrait that one of the residents did of me, and then she added all of the things that she loved, her tea and flowers, and so it's a really good, I still have that piece. The collage box was organized in file folders titled Animals, People, Places, and Things. Some residents enjoyed just looking for images and cutting them out and keeping the files all up to date and in order. Some stories seem more difficult than others. Gail was only in her mid-50s when she became a resident. She had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 8 years prior to coming to our home. She had also developed Lewy bodies, a form of dementia that's related to Parkinson's, but the art therapy program, in her own words, gives me something to get up for in the morning. She had been an artist her whole life, as you can see. This piece was a collaboration of sorts. I needed an image for a poster for our fundraiser, Art from the Heart, a fundraiser for both our music therapy and art therapy programs, and I put down the music score on the paper, and then she painted it, and I created the artwork for the poster, and that's part of the events that are going on for the day, and welcome to people. It was an extraordinary event. We raised $10,000 for our art therapy and music therapy programming, which is great, but the hard part is we're always having to raise money for something that really makes a difference. And I was one of the lucky ones who had a paid position, but it wasn't guaranteed that there would always be funding to keep the program going. Mr. Forbes is a veteran with some wonderful stories to tell. He often drew his truck, the one he drove for North Cross Oil, for years. His long-term memory was good, and his drawing skills and memory recall enhanced and helped him relive those days. He loved the activity of painting and would tell me after each painting session how wonderful it made him feel. I wish I could do this every day, he would always say. He regularly painted birdhouses, and you can see here, pictured in the garden, a whole group of his, and we auctioned these off at the Art from the Heart, and Margaret, the occupational therapist, she actually bought all of them and put them in her garden. So this little box I made, and he painted it for me for a spring display, and he said that painting made him feel useful again. And I found men, if you could, they were a little bit reluctant, this art stuff. But if I could tell them I had a project that I needed help with, off you go. They were really, interested in being helpful and doing a project. So I had to learn that. So these are some of the benefits of art therapy described by the third hand, providing increased self-esteem, life enhancement, increased sensory and motor stimulation,
restores confidence, affirms identity, short and long-term memory stimulation, symbolic functioning, and just this connection. It just opens people's hearts. So I found also, though, what I noticed was people's loneliness, their depression. People talked about feeling discarded, afraid, and they were confused. I knew from my own experience with my mother and my family, we needed to talk about end-of-life issues, not just the practical details. We needed to talk about crossing that threshold. We needed to talk about that mystery. What did I think about this going home? Could I help residents feel open to sharing their thoughts? If my family needed to talk about this, I felt the residents deserved this opportunity as well. I began thinking, what kind of a creative project would help me do that? So the idea for the Dignity Quilt, it wasn't a flash of insight born whole. It evolved over time. Like the bee in this quilt square, many flowers were visited to pollinate the process before all the pieces came together. As a gardener, I think a lot about seeds. How does something so tiny produce such beauty and utility? A seed is less a physical object than it is the germ of a process. The act of creating has these same inherent qualities. Start with an intention, water it with attention, and invite the muse. A work of art will start to come to life. The bee had already begun to pollinate my ideas. The process of creating the quilt grew out of my own need to talk about the long goodbye of dementia and my sense that the residents did too. So what do we mean when we say dignity? The dictionary had several definitions, but I liked the meaning from the Latin root dignus, meaning worth or worthy. The residents were worthy, their stories worth listening to, and their images worth seeing. They were worth being heard by an empathic ear. Empathy calls upon us to empty our mind and listen to others with our whole being. Whether there are words or only images or shapes, this empty attentiveness allowed residents to convey what they needed to say or describe their image without interpretation or projection. So let's look at some of those images. One of the first seeds of the project began after I saw a needle-felted quilt at another facility. I talked with our director, telling her I wanted to use this needle-felting quilt square format to open a sensitive dialogue with residents about their feelings about death and dying. She liked the idea and remembered an article she had seen about dignity quilts. They had been made by a community quilting group and had been used to cover residents during their last days. This sparked another idea for us of creating a ritual to actually put the quilt into service. It would be not just a symbol of the circle of life, but an important part of a ritual to honor residents' lives. We decided we would cover residents after their passing with the quilt, and then a staff member would also accompany them through the facility to the main entrance on their final journey. In my conversations with residents while we were working together to make the square, I let the imagery lead my questions. Once the image was complete, invariably there was usually an opening to bring up the circle of life. Something seasonal, heart-related, or as you can see, circles. They emerged with regularity. Some became flowers or suns. Many were only a circle, single or in a grouping. A simple yet powerful metaphor about completion. We come full circle. We close the circle. The circle is a balanced and pleasing shape, easy to form and embellish, a good place to start, and a good place to end. The process of actually making the squares would usually begin by showing the resident a photo of the needle-felted quilt created at the other facility. I would tell them our home was making a quilt, too, and invite them to participate. Most people were intrigued. Making the quilt squares with residents was about more than just the imagery. Made from raw fleece, dyed in rainbow hues, it was soft to the touch, stimulating to the senses, and often promoted memories. Not everyone, staff included, recognized the raw wool, but residents said things like, "It smells like an old sweater," or "It feels soft, like petting a dog." I would then show them how to tease it apart and form simple shapes on the black broadcloth background taped onto the foam rubber pad to protect their lap. This also created a stable working surface. You can see the lap board here. It's a piece of rigid insulation, the kind that you put in your walls that you get free when you've got a job that's been done. The foam rubber block is taped on the top and absorbs the needles poking through. The black wool fabric square is taped down to the foam rubber. The needle is a specialized tool with a protective sheath covering the needles that retracts when you press it down through the layers. This process begins to anchor the fleece and the image begins to take form. Even residents with minimal strength can manage creating a square. I let them rest their hand on mine while they direct me through their color preferences and embellishments as shapes become images to them. Again, the support of the third hand. Once the image was completed and ready to be admired, it would lead me into the gentle inquiry into their feelings about their own personal circle of life. Each one of these squares represents a story. Some residents were very open to talking about their feelings, others a little reluctant, but everyone's response was very positive when the ritual for the completed quilt was described. When I told them that the quilt was a symbolic tribute to dignify their final passage, that their body would be covered with the quilt, and a staff member would accompany them to the main entrance as a way of honoring this final goodbye, and for other residents and staff to bear witness to the last phase in their circle of life. Every resident or person I've described this ritual to has simply said, "That's beautiful." Rituals serve to embody and enhance life processes. They allow us to acknowledge and incorporate even the most profound emotions of grief and loss. Our goal at the home was to include everyone, staff, residents, family members, and visitors, in our efforts to enlighten this difficult subject with respect and sensitivity. As the images for the quilt accumulated, I would let the residents staple theirs to the bulletin board in the main hallway. Everyone began to take ownership of this quilt and its intentions. Martha contributed most of the heart images and helped pin the squares together, and her devoted husband, Hugh, helped iron the seams flat when they were sewn together. Most of the squares were made by residents, but one afternoon, a resident's daughter and her friend arrived while I was working with her mom. They were intrigued, so I invited them to participate as well. They each made a square with us. The daughter made several more squares, volunteering her time to help with the support of the project. Her mom, Rose, a lively Irish woman prone to breaking into song and dance right up to her passing, was one of the first residents to have the honor of using the quilt. Every square has a story. This beautiful tree and landscape was also created by Doreen, the same woman who created the bee and the flower. I had Doreen make the first square because I knew her feedback would be helpful and a good gauge for me of how all this might work with residents. After her square was finished and I told her about the quilt ritual, I asked her about her own circle of life and how she felt. She said, "You know, I'm quite concerned. I've donated my body to the anatomy department at UBC where I used to work. I'm wondering if the funeral home driver will know where to deliver my body." Now, this was not the response that I expected, but I quickly confirmed for her that I would check with the office and make sure that people knew what her wishes were. So her wishes were kind of practical, But I talked extensively with Doreen at other times about the whole process of her life and what her expectations were and how she was doing. So she was a kick. As the images began to accumulate on the bulletin board, it became clear to me that the project and the quilt had captured both staff and family members' imagination. As a true timeless work of art, the quilt had developed a life of its own and was teaching all of us. One afternoon, a nurse stopped me in the hall to tell me how meaningful she found the project. She was leaving her shift and taking a short leave of absence. There had been several residents pass away in the last few weeks, and she needed some time off. She continued to tell me how attached she becomes to the residents. Tears welled up in her eyes as she thanked me again for opening up the sensitive topic of death and dying. I realized then how important the ritual of the quilt was in helping our care providers at the home. We often forget that they are the people that spend 24/7 with our loved ones, do most of the heavy lifting, soothe anxieties, and hold residents when they need a hug. That the staff felt included and had taken ownership of the quilt showed me just how effective it was at educating all of us and providing a format to create essential and authentic dialogue around a difficult subject. Besides being helpful to staff and family members, the quilt has even begun to educate others. Our executive director, Penny Donaldson, shared this recent story with me about how one person at a time, the project is increasing awareness and helping to include others in its expanding circle. She had arrived early one morning. One of the residents had passed away, and the funeral home had just arrived to pick up the body. It was just at shift change, and she decided to deliver the quilt herself to the resident's room. When she arrived, the two healthcare workers from the unit were outside the resident's room, and the woman from the funeral home was blocking the door and holding the doorknob with her hands enclosed in blue latex gloves. Her job appeared to be to protect everyone from the body, while she left her co-worker to try and manage dealing alone, getting the body onto the gurney. Penny, holding the quilt in her arms, explained to her that we had a ritual at our home that included covering a resident with the quilt and accompanying them to the main entrance. "Well, that's not going to do any good now," was the woman's response. Now, Penny is a kind and compassionate person, and she persisted with her explanation that the ritual helped other residents to honor one another and process their own feelings of loss. The woman says, "But all these people are demented. They can't even talk." Penny said to me, "This woman had attitude. Picture the combative character actor, Kathy Bates, in blue rubber gloves." Penny continued to clarify for her this was absolutely not the case, and that in fact all of the 56 squares of the quilt had been made by the residents. Reluctantly, the woman allowed her into the room. Penny, along with both of the healthcare workers who had witnessed the exchange, all walked together to accompany the resident to the main entrance. At this point, the difficult woman turned to Penny and, with a new, gentler tone in her voice, said, "We will take good care of her from here. You can be sure of that." The stories of our dignity quilt continue. Dr. Dahlia Gottlieb Tanaka, founder of the Society for the Arts and Dementia Care, helped me get one of the squares on the cover of the magazine Alzheimer's Review. It's the one with the bee and the flower. And inside is a brief bio of the artist Doreen and an explanation of the project and a picture of Doreen working on the piece. Dahlia also used this image for the Society Conference's logo in 2008. Doreen was so honored. She felt so appreciated. She made copies of the magazine cover, and her daughter helped her send them to everyone they knew. So timeless art often reflects and speaks to the cultural dynamic and brings things to light that need to be known. How ironic that people with dementia are teaching us not only how to live more in the moment, but how to die with dignity. Sitting with residents and listening to their stories and feelings about their own circle of life has been an honor and a blessing for me. It helped me immeasurably in coming to terms with my own losses. I now know with all my heart that grieving our losses is the way to incorporate and move beyond them. Dying is a natural part of living, and when shared with respect and sensitivity, can bring us closest to our deepest and most authentic self. Both my folks went home, as they like to call it, in the summer of 2009, within 3 weeks of one another. So I'm going to just leave you with this lovely Sufi saying. There's my Sufi saying. There. When the heart grieves for what is lost, the spirit rejoices over what is left. So it's a touching and beautiful experience, isn't it? Yeah. I can feel that you're all moved. You've been probably one of the best audiences I've ever had.
We came a long way to be with you.
That's right. That's right. So if anybody has any questions, wants to know more, I just recently was invited by a care facility in North Vancouver called Inglewood Care Center. They heard about my project. They didn't even see the presentation. I had to cancel it to be with a friend, a close friend that was dying. And they wanted to talk to me. And this woman called me up and she said, could you come to our care facility? We'll pay you. We want you to give the presentation. We want to know more. We want to do it. So I spent a day at their care facility with them and made the presentation and gave a workshop, and I've talked with Bohana, the woman that's kind of heading it up, several more times, because they're not art therapists, they're activities workers and recreation people, and they're a little bit intimidated by the idea of talking with residents about death and dying. So I'm coaching them a bit on that. But I'm just so pleased that they want to take that on, because they really feel the need in their facility to start to have this conversation. And, you know, that's why we're all here, is to have this conversation. I'm excited for Trudy James' new film. She's a grief and loss counselor in the Seattle area, and it's a documentary called Speaking About Dying, mm-hmm. and she's fundraised for it, and it's nearly completed, and it's just happening everywhere that people...
Trudy wanted to be here. I work with Trudy, too. She wanted to be here for this, but she's getting over pneumonia.
Oh, dear. Mm-hmm. She's been working really hard, I know, getting her film ready. So...
Could you explain again the concept of third hand?
All right. So it's the use of imagination and virtuosity, my creativity, what I know about art, in the empathic service of others. And it's like these recreation people, they're frightened to sit down because they don't have that experience of being a creative person to bring to something. And so they need more experience being actually creating, so that they have the confidence to be able to do it. So by being a lifelong artist, I can see where people are kind of balking at something and just divert them a little bit and say something like, what's your favorite color? Or, hey, maybe you'd like to try sticking some of these down on the paper. And they can say yes or no. But it's just, I just keep the flow going through my own imagination and my own creativity. And whenever I sit down to work with people, I've got an arsenal of stuff out there to help me. You know, I don't walk in cold. I've got paper already taped down on the board. I spray the paint so that they don't have to spend a lot of time, you know, working them up. So just my knowledge and process that I know about painting and creating, I can get somebody painting right away so they're not being stymied by their own inability or their lack of knowledge to paint. So I can support them through the process. And then they can experience the result of, like, yellow right away on the paper, and we can both go like, ooh, that looks nice, you know? So that's what that means.
Can you turn to the quote that you have at the beginning, in a world without dementia?
Yeah.
I'd like to read that again.
Okay.
Thank you.
That is a wonderful quote, and it's by a man called Maurice Friedel, and he started this dementia advocacy and support network. He's from Australia, and he had dementia. Mm. And he and another woman who wrote a book called Dancing with Dementia, Christine Bryden, she's also from Australia, and she wrote this book about, she had early onset dementia, so she developed it in her 50s, and her husband and her had just gotten married. And she wrote this whole book during that early period of what it was like, you know, to be told. And it's a very powerful book. Mm-hmm. So they started this dementia advocacy and support group together.
What I find is remarkable, Patty, is that I, you know, when I think about my sister and other people with Alzheimer's that I saw, mm-hmm. The ability to concentrate or to focus is so limited. It's remarkable to me that you could, that what you were doing was a way of focusing.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about, you know, people who, my sister couldn't remember, she would open a letter and look around and then look down and, where did this come from?
Right.
And this is maybe 5 seconds. So it's remarkable to me that you would be able to keep that focus there. That's a testament to something that's going on in that.
It is. It's that power of supported autonomy, that power of not talking about all the things you don't know and learning something new at the same time. And it just is... It's remarkably magical when that can happen. I rarely had someone become agitated during the experience. This woman here, her name was Laura, and she also had early onset. And she was a big woman. It was when I first started working there, they said, we want you to evaluate Laura. She's lost most of her vocabulary, and she can't... seemed to focus on anything, and because she was such a big, young woman, she was kind of intimidating. But I went into her room, and in order for me to find out if she could even understand what I was saying, I said, Laura, we have to move a few things around in here so we can sit down and paint. Can you help me move these chairs? Well, she started moving the chairs. And so I knew she understood what I was saying to her, and all she could say was, Obader, Obader, and she kept repeating that. But as soon as I got her sat down and we started working, I said, can you make a wavy line like this? And I don't know which of the, I think this is my wavy line. And then she started making a wavy line. And I said, well, what other kind of lines can you make? And so she started making other lines. And then I would put something in concrete, like that's my bird. And we ended up with this garden of just creativity and lines and color. And she had this real way of doing that, you know, really fast and getting it down. And I can show you some of her other work, because as things progressed, those lines got pretty complex. This is another one of her pieces, and what I'm doing is we started with this up there, and then I shoved the thing over to her, and it ended up being upside down. But what I saw was the Olympic Mountains, and I didn't say this to her, and this is the water, and so I put a sailboat in there, you know, and she just loved that exchange, and We were creating together. Yeah. Yeah. You know, we weren't talking necessarily about a lot of things, but we could see something happen, and we could express our joy together in
that
experience.
It was elemental on the level that she was at.
Yeah.
Whereas, I think what I saw was the frustration of trying to remember a word, or remember a date, or remember
right.
how to hold a fork, mm-hmm. or there was, you know, this sense of kind of like recall and being barraged by this incessant need to kind of pull up data that was getting increasingly hard. And here I could see, you know, it's sort of moving forward and away, you know.
Well, yeah, and I'm not asking her, don't you remember Uncle Fred? He's sending his,
right.
you know, greetings. And I would watch family members with all the best of intentions and love try and communicate in the way that they
yeah.
used to know this person rather than the person that they had become.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I was the same way with my mom. I would could do things with her, but I remember one time being on the ward, and we were playing music, and we were dancing with the different residents, and they loved that. You know, we were just having a ball, dancing to old familiar tunes. Well, I started dancing with my mom, and I just choked up, and I had to pass her off to one of the other caregivers and step around the corner and just cry. Because it was my mom. But when it was somebody else's mom, I could just get right up there with them and just,
yeah.
you know, be there for them.
Wow.
And have, in and full heart, and, but not in, you know, that despair of losing this person. Yeah. And having them not be who they were.
I don't want to hog anything, but I have one more question. Just, did you notice there was... I mean, how far along could you get patients? I mean, like, you know, is there a point where you just found that you were hitting a limit in terms of their progression of their Alzheimer's?
It depends on each person.
So it was fairly...
It was, I mean, I worked with this one man who was from Germany, and he spoke, like, several different languages, but we spoke mostly in English, and... he had other related issues besides dementia, but he was fairly lost in terms of his short-term memory and that. And a couple of days before he died, I saw him for one of the last times, and I always would get down and he was in a wheelchair right close to him, so I was talking, you know, with him directly. And thanked him for all the opportunities that we'd had to work together, and he took my hand like I was just a princess, and he was such a gentleman, and he kissed my hand. And you know, so, and he died 2 days later. Yeah So, you know, all sorts of, I worked with people that had no vocabulary at all, and we would do those conversation things like I did with Laura that I'm looking for, where I would make a mark, and then they would make a mark. And then I would make a mark, and they would make a mark. And we'd end up with these conversation paintings. And here's a bunch of them with Laura. Because that's the way I kept her going. You can see. I would make a star, and then here's her little stars up here. You know? See them across the top?
Mm-hmm.
And this was that first time that I sat with her, and we were looking out the window, and there was a garden path, and there was a house in the distance. And I made that house there. So, and she could tell. We were looking out there, and she would make things that she could say. Like, I made these flowers, and then she made some, and they're kind of loopy and strange, but she could mimic what I was doing. And so... together, you know, we're creating this picture, this conversation painting. And it was a great... I worked with her for over an hour, and people couldn't even get her to sit still, you know, for 1 minute. She'd be up and charging down the hall.
Right,
again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And the sad story is that there's no longer an art therapy program at my facility because they... you know, needed a new roof on the facility. They need, you know, it's just a budgeting thing, but I only, for 2 days a week, you know, made $16,000 a year. I think anybody can find that kind of money for this kind of contact and process and progress. That and that feeling, even though it's momentary and passing, I saw it last in the way that people would recognize me, you know,
that
again.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, and I'd pull out their work and I'd say, remember you did this? Oh, I did that? Oh, yeah, you know, and they would remember their work. And then they would remember, I saw people learn new skills. They could be sat down and given the materials and, you know, get them started. And I'd say, are you okay on your own for a while I work with, you know, this? Oh, yeah, you know, and I'd come back and there'd just be painting all over the place and all over the, you know, page and stuff. One lady called it going into the wild blue yonder. She said, we're going into the wild blue yonder today. And so that's what we called it all the time, was the wild blue yonder. And also what they loved was helping me clean up. You know, whereas the thing in facilities, they do everything for people. They don't have time. They got to get it done. They got to get on to the next person. But people could fold laundry. They love to wipe tables. They just like to feel useful. I had more fun. I could just be a complete idiot. You know, just a comic. And they would love it, you know. And it just really freed me up to be more of myself. I didn't know that about myself, that me and old people really get along.
One thing that I can see, too, that got me, and if anybody else has that, but there was a sense of despair that I would often feel. I would look forward to going and seeing my sister, and then after 20 or 30 minutes, she would be impatient with me, and she did not want to. She was restless, and I would despair at how I could connect. Occasionally, the group would come and sing music, and I would see her laugh and sing along or something. And suddenly, she would be crystal clear. She could sing two or three verses to a song, and then it would go. And how, there was no sustaining. There was no flashes of connection. But it was just an emptiness that sort of set in that is very despairing.
Right, and that is dementia, you know. It is the hard part about it. And you can only do so many things a day with people. They get tired, and once they're tired, then it's even more difficult for them sometimes. But once they're tired, they need to rest. And so then, you know, they're resting. They're not agitated. And it really does take away a lot of that agitation and the need for medications, which keep people really stupefied and increases falls, you know, and then you have, you know, person with the broken hip and stuff like that. So there's so many benefits that are on beyond just the actual activity of painting or singing songs or dancing or moving, you know. Those are all really wonderful things to do with people. They just need more of it instead of the old regime of, you know, the recreation. It's not that those things, you know, a little tease for people or making something crafty isn't, you know, valuable, but there's so much more that they can do that gives them so much more a feeling of meaning. And the people doing the activities gives them more feeling of meaning.
Is this the kind of thing you could train? I mean, you have an art background. But without somebody, I mean, if somebody had said, there's a 3-day workshop you can take on how to do this with your sister or whatever, or, you know, is there a way to pass along to people who don't have an art background? Is there a transferability to it?
Well, I think that some of the things, like this specific project of the Dignity Quilt, I can show people how to do that process of the dignity of the needle felting with people, but you can't give people instant empathy or the ability to be spontaneous and empathic and creative all at once. That's something that just it comes over time for people, and some people never learn it, you know, unfortunately. Yeah.
I was just thinking about what you said. I kind of had a thought I hadn't had before.
you talked about the moments of connecting with your sister, and then you talked about kind of despairing that that moment was fleeting, didn't last very long. And I was thinking, what is that saying about us? That whatever that was that we had wasn't enough, mm-hmm. or that we want more of that, or we, you know, there's proof of, I don't know what it's proof of exactly, mm-hmm. but it just, I saw myself in that mm-hmm. in that pondering, you know, when people do what they can and respond how they can in the moment, is that not enough?
Sometimes it is, I think.
Well, and it's all they have. I spent some time with my aunt a year ago in Michigan at her Alzheimer's place, and I didn't expect her to recognize me, but I couldn't connect. Mm-hmm. And she wanted out of there, and everything was wrong, and she was mad at, and it was hard. It was hard, and the people loved her there. I mean, I spent some time thinking about what's going on with me that's. I mean, I guess I want more for her. Whatever all that is, it just took me to that place of what is that about us that wants more than what we can have or something, or that what there is not enough.
I felt that most with my mom.
Yeah.
The piece of people close to me. I was could be more detached with other residents, but it was also exhausting being with that way with residents, sitting with them, doing the work. I mean, I had to be so present and so on top of my game the whole time I was with them. I would go home and all I could do was lie down on the floor, you know, because I was so tired, because you use your energy, they use your energy. It's a bridge for them. You know, you supply them with that third hand, you know, and they use it. But yet they're doing everything. They're creating it. But without you, they wouldn't get there. And
part of them is coming out.
Yeah.
That it has stayed dormant or whatever that is.
And so that's a rich experience for everyone. And I would have loved to have given that to way more residents than I... But I could only see so many residents a day, and I would have to take a break, you know.
I think in part, not totally, but in part it's the quote that you had from Morris.
Mm-hmm.
We want the rational, we want the person as we knew them before.
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to communicate in the ways that we're used to communicating.
And that we're comfortable with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's not the whole answer, but that's, from my experience, part of it.
Yeah.
And that's why that quote is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, the person is in there, their essence is in there. And it comes out in glimmers.
Mm-hmm.
Like a firefly, it comes out and then it's gone. It's as if they had, with someone with cancer, you can sometimes see that illness. It's a physical thing, not always, but sometimes. But with dementia, it's not something you can see, but it covers up the essence of the person. But that person is still there.
Yeah, I found with my mom one of the things. My mom was a very private person and kind of an introvert. And I would just take her out, and they had lovely gardens there. And we'd go out into Polly's garden. It was the one facility garden upstairs, a beautiful balcony. And I would just sit with her and sit across from her. And she'd nod off, you know, and we'd hum a little bit. And I'd just hold her hand. And then sometimes I'd dry, oh, look at this, look at that. And that was just letting go, and I finally realized there was nothing I was going to change. I wasn't going to do anything better for my mom than just my presence of being with her and sitting with her in whatever phase and stage that she was in that day. And I let go of any expectations at a certain point and just enjoyed what I could with her. I used to take her for drives, you know, and she'd kind of nod off, and I'd have nice music on, and we'd go through Beacon Hill Park, at all the time, nearly every time I took her for a drive. And every time it was new for her. Oh, isn't this a lovely place? You know, yeah, you know, you want to get out and walk around. I don't know how many millions of times I did that with her, but she loved it. And, you know, so just do the same old thing.
We have to close because people are kind of getting ready to come in. Thank you, Patty, so much.
Well, I look forward to having some of you.